What we sometimes hear, therefore, is the medium's voice through the trumpet, though it sounds quite unlike his own, as it always does in trance, and this form of communication is different from the direct voice, because the voice is conveyed to the trumpet and not produced quite apart from the medium. At times they tell me that they can convey the voice into the trumpet right across the circle. At Sloane seances we have, therefore, three different forms of communication. Firstly, trance utterances. Secondly, by means of the method just described, and thirdly, the best of all, voices from etheric men, women and children who have materialized their vocal organs and lungs and speak as we do, without any connection whatever with the medium, except the ectoplasmic substance necessary for materialization which they borrow from the medium and sitters. The trumpet is moved by materialized rods, made by a combination of these substances supplied by the medium, the sitters and their chemist. It can be moved also by a materialized hand, and the larger end is used to rest the materialized mouth on, inside the trumpet, thus directing the voice in the direction the speaker desires to speak without his requiring to move from the place where he has materialized. Either end of the trumpet can be used, whichever suits their purpose best. When the trumpet is not used, it means that the substance is sufficient, and the power strong enough, to enable one or more materializations to take place, usually in the vicinity of the person to whom the communicator wishes to speak. Thus, I have heard, on occasion, two and sometimes three voices speaking to different people at the same time. Not always, however, is the person present who purports to speak, as those who have passed through what is called the second transition, onto a higher plane of thought, find it difficult, if not impossible, to communicate. They, however, can communicate with those in the lower plane, their messages being picked up and passed on by some Aetherian present at the seance. This, I think, is often done, even by those on the surface of a sphere bordering this earth who find communication difficult by means of materializing their own vocal organs. An Irishman in etheric life, named Galleka, told me that much of his time at a seance was occupied in taking messages and passing them on. He calls himself the telephone exchange. I asked once if the materialized vocal organs could be touched and had weight, and was told they could be, and that they had the weight that we, the sitters, had lost during the sitting. If we each sat on a weighing machine, we would find our weight during the seance gradually decreasing, and, as the seance neared an end, as the ectoplasm was returned, so would our weight return to normal. The experiments by Dr. Crawford, and others, have proved this statement to be correct. This ectoplasm, which they draw from us, is useless unless it is mixed with ingredients supplied by the chemist, as materialization could not take place from ectoplasm alone. This ectoplasm-etheric combination is, I am told, the preparation required, not only for materialization, but for the movement by those in the other world of all physical objects. They can move nothing on earth without it. Our bodies are composed of the ingredients from which they draw this substance called ectoplasm. I have found it impossible, however, to get any detailed information as to what are the chemical ingredients of the substance they add to the ectoplasm. The chemist would not tell me, as he said I could not understand even if he did. I asked once if the thoughts of the medium in any way colored the communications which came by means of the direct voice, and the reply I received was, certainly not. As to what takes place when the medium speaks in trance, I am told that the Aetherian wishing to speak gathers ectoplasm from the medium, and thus gets control of his vocal organs. So far as Sloane is concerned, his brain is not used in any way. What happens is briefly this. The ectoplasm from the connecting link between the Aetherian speaking and the medium's vocal organs, and, as the Aetherian speaks, so the medium's vocal organs move. Here materialization of the mouth, throat and tongue does not take place, the medium's vocal organs being used to vibrate the atmosphere, and form the words spoken by the controlling etheric man, woman or child. My claim for this book is that it gives an explanation, both logical and reasonable, of how the phenomenon of the direct voice occurs, and one which should appeal to everyone. Evidence, such as is contained in the next four chapters, may not in itself be sufficient to convince the average individual. But, when a logical explanation can also be given, an acceptance of the phenomenon is much less difficult. I have created conditions so as to make fraud and impersonation impossible, and, by persistent inquiry, have obtained information about the etheric world, its inhabitants and how communication takes place, which should satisfy the average individual. This has never been attempted before, to my knowledge, in the same systematic way, but it must be remembered that I have dealt with hard facts all my life. I have required a knowledge of economics and mathematics in my business life, and, outside of this, my special interest has been in physics. I have therefore approached this subject in a matter-of-fact way, and have obtained information which makes the phenomena, to my unbiased person, both reasonable and natural. Consequently, this inquiry should help to raise the study of psychic phenomena to a higher plane of thought, and be another stepping stone towards its being ultimately placed on a strictly scientific basis. Chapter 7. My First Evidence. The search for truth is the noblest occupation of man, and its publication is a duty. The Stale. The previous chapters must be considered in the light of an introduction to the subject of this book. I now come to the kernel of the whole affair, namely, the evidence, and it is on the evidence that everything rests and the whole argument is built up. It may be contended that the evidence should have come first and the deductions last. But, in a case such as this, one has to prepare the ground so that the possibility of communication is primarily accepted, and what takes place at a séance understood. In 1918 my wife became seriously ill and had to be removed to a nursing home in Glasgow, where she had an operation, from which she recovered and was fortunately none the worse. To be near to her I stayed in Glasgow, and, when sitting with her one Sunday evening, I remarked that I would like some fresh air and would go out for a stroll. Little did I think what that walk would mean to me, but it was the beginning of an entire change in my mental outlook on life and death. I sauntered down one street and up another rather aimlessly, to pass a church with the name Spiritualist Church prominently displayed in the foreground. I stopped to see what it looked like, as I did not remember having seen it before, and I was unaware that such a denomination existed. What little I knew of spiritualism was contained in a book my wife had recently been given and which to me, by a casual glance, seemed too fantastic for serious thought. I threw it aside as not worth reading, and now that Sunday evening I was facing the entrance to a spiritualist church. Why not enter and see what it is like inside? I thought, and this I did. A service was going on and the speaker was telling the congregation of some wonderful things he had experienced. I sat down and listened, and when the service was over I went up to him and this is what I said, "Do you really expect me to believe what you said tonight? It may have gone down with some simple-minded people who listened to you, but do you expect a rational thinker to accept as true what you said? Can you prove it to me?" I have from time to time challenged a parson with questions, and have received as a reply, "No, I can prove nothing, but that is where faith comes in. You must believe and not doubt." The spiritualist, whom I now challenged, said exactly the opposite, to the effect that I could not be expected to believe without proof. "Proof is essential," he continued, "and what spiritualists believe has come from experience. All claims made by spiritualists can be proved, and if you want to have proof you can get it." "How?" I inquired. "By going to a medium," he answered. "Can you take me to one?" I asked. "Yes, tomorrow night, if that is convenient to you," he replied. That reply appealed to me, and I accepted his offer. So it was arranged that the following night I would meet him at 7 o'clock at the corner of North Frederick Street and George Street, and he would take me to a séance which was held every Monday evening in a house nearby. When I returned and told my wife where I was about to go, she wondered if it were a wise thing to do. To go with a strange man to a strange house seemed to her taking an unjustifiable risk, but she raised no objection and I kept the appointment the next day as arranged. Consequently, on the following day, Monday, 20th of September 1918, we met at the place arranged and walked along a quiet street to a house, the entrance to which was by a passage. He told me we were going to the house of John Sloan, who was a medium. We entered the passage, and my unknown guide knocked at the door on the right-hand side. It was opened, and we were ushered into a small room in which were 10 people, all sitting on chairs in a circle. The light was on and talking was general. A man was playing a hymn on a harmonium. We were both given seats in the circle and no introductions were made. All that was said by my guide was a remark to the man at the harmonium that he had brought someone with him. That was all. My guide did not know my name, I did not know his underscore, and the rest of the people were all complete strangers to me. I put them down as belonging to what is called the working class. Nice, kindly, decent people who gave me a very friendly welcome. The man at the harmonium then said it was time to start, and he switched off the light. A hymn was played and sung and then another, but before it ended the organist turned round and took his place in the circle. Shortly after this a man's loud voice spoke right in front of my right-hand neighbor. I heard everything said and the name it gave, the conversation being an intimate one between my female neighbor and this voice. She had evidently spoken to the voice before, and took it all quietly and naturally. The voice seemed to know everything of importance she had done since the last conversation, and ended with love and the promise to be back again at the next sense. When the voice had finished speaking, she calmly announced to everyone that she had been speaking to her husband, whom I took to be dead. This went on for 3 hours, dozens of voices speaking to different people, men's voices, women's voices, children's voices, all of which I was told came from people called dead. A woman's voice spoke to a man sitting on my left. It gave a name and referred to happenings at his home. It specially referred to Tom, who was giving his further trouble, and then came advice as to how he should be dealt with. Intimate family matters were discussed between my neighbor and this female voice, and finally with love it said goodbye. That was my wife, he whispered to me. I never come here but she comes back to me. She always knows everything that goes on at home. I was now beginning to feel that I was the only one to be omitted from this strange medley of conversation which seemed to go on and on without stopping. Everything said was claimed to be correct, and I wondered how it was possible for any human being to be so intimate with all the dead friends, and the private doings of the sitters, as to be able to impersonate their deceased relations in the way that was taking place. Not only did the imagined impersonator know intimately about their dead friends and relations, but every voice was different, the mannerisms were different, in fact each voice had a different personality. What a wonderful actor there must be among us to be able to carry on like this for hours on end, and to remember in the dark where everyone was sitting, as the right person, was directly addressed every time with never a mistake. Such were my thoughts, when suddenly right in front of my face a strong voice spoke to me. Yes, who are you? I inquired, to receive the answer. Your father, Robert Downey Findlay. The voice continued speaking, and referred to something that only my father and I, and one other man, ever knew about on earth, and that other man, like my father, was dead. I was therefore the only living person on earth with any knowledge of what the voice was talking about. It was a private matter that neither I, nor my father, nor any other man when on earth, ever spoke about to any other person. All this was extraordinary enough, but imagine my surprise when my father concluded by saying, David Kidston is standing beside me and would also like to talk to you about this matter. Now David Kidston was the name of the other man who knew about this private affair. He was my father's partner, and he was my partner after my father's death. Only the three of us knew about this private affair, and here I was in a Glasgow artisan's house, a complete stranger to everyone, being told by two different voices about something known only to me and two dead men. Moreover, the voices which spoke claimed to be the voices of these two men. And Kidston continued the conversation quite naturally which my father had started, to conclude with these words. I am glad to get that off my chest at last. When I first wrote On the Edge of the Etheric, I included in it this experience and others I had with this medium. But I gave no details as to what the voices said to me on this occasion. I thought it wiser then to give an outline of what happened and no more, as to recount what the voice, which claimed to come from my father, said, and what the voice, claiming to come from Kidston, said, would have involved too much explanation before the matter could be understood. However, now that my past life has been made public in my autobiography, looking back, there is no reason why everything should not be told. What my father said after giving his name was this: "I am very sorry I did not take you into my business. I would have liked to do so, but Kidston opposed it. If you had been with me, it would have greatly eased my life, as I found business a great strain on me. David Kidston is standing beside me and would also like to talk to you about this matter." Then a voice claiming to be that of David Kidston spoke, saying, "I am David Kidston. I was wrong opposing your coming into our office. I am sorry I did it, but now you need have no regrets. I am glad to get that off my chest at last." That was all true, but only my father, myself and Kidston knew about it, and the incident referred to happened when my grandfather died in 1904, 14 years previously. When he passed on, I said to my father that I would like to enter Findlay, Kidston and Gough's office, as now my prospects of becoming a partner in Patrick Henderson and Company were not so bright. My grandfather's influence had gone, and I might have to wait years before I became a partner. My father agreed, and said he would speak to Kidston about it, as I would be a great help to him. My disappointment was great when he told me that Kidston would not agree, because the business earned enough for only three partners. He evidently foresaw the day when my father would want me to become a partner, and that would mean less to go round. Kidston was so short-sighted that he could not foresee me bringing in enough new business to the firm to justify my being made a partner. But he was a very difficult man to work with, and my father had some unpleasant times with him. He was gruff, short in his manner and domineering, so much so that my father rather feared him. So I knew that what Kidston had said was final, and I never raised the matter again. But, as neither he nor Gough had sons, I saw something good slipping away from me. So my request and its refusal remained known only to us three. Nevertheless, here was I listening to what had happened 14 years previously, in a strange house, and in the company of people I had never seen before in my life. That indeed was a problem. No spy system, however thorough it was, no fraud or impersonation by the medium or anyone else could be responsible for what I had experienced. I was up against something quite inexplicable. That, then, was my first introduction to spiritualism. And, when the séance was over, I was introduced to the medium, John Campbell Sloane, the man who was at the harmonium when I entered. I thanked him for his hospitality, and asked him if I could come back again, as I was anxious to know more about this subject. I left Sloane's house in company with the man who took me there, and he accepted my experience as a matter of course. "That is how people become spiritualists," he said. "I told you I could prove to you what I said last night, and, you see, I have done so." He told me his name was Duncan MacPherson, and I found out later that he was a much respected leader in the Glasgow spiritualist movement, he himself being a medium. Some years later he died and returned to a séance at which my brother was present in Manchester. He, MacPherson, spoke to my brother and said that it was he who had taken me to my first séance after meeting me at the Scottish Mediums Union Church one Sunday evening. My brother replied, "I think you are wrong. You met my brother at the Holland Street Spiritualist Church." "No, I did not," was the reply. "It was at the Scottish Mediums Union Church, 100 West Regent Street, I first met your brother, and I took him the next day to Sloane's. Ask your brother and you will find out that I am right." So my brother asked me next time we met. He was wrong, and the voice claiming to be that of MacPherson was right. It was at the Scottish Mediums Union Church that we first 84. met, so that telepathy, if telepathy can produce a voice, which it can't do, is not the explanation of how this happened. During the next 5 years I attended 39 seances with Sloane, sometimes at his house and at times in places of my own choosing. 83 separate voices have spoken to me or to friends I have taken with me. I have given details in this book of the precautions I took to make sure it was not Sloane who was speaking. I sat with him at times alone and the voices spoke even when my ear was within an inch of his mouth, which was silent. Two and three voices sometimes spoke at the same time. Occasionally the voices were so strong that they could be heard across the street. The most convincing experiences were when I took strangers to a séance. Sloane knew nothing about them and I never mentioned their names. Here are a few instances which come under this category. One evening I took with me the widow of a man whose body had been cremated that day and whose funeral I attended. I introduced her to Sloane by another name. A voice spoke to me when the séance began, "Why did you give the lady's wrong name? We know who she is, and her husband, Louis Pearson, is here to speak to her." Pearson then spoke, remarking that it would take him some time to recover from seeing his earth body burned. When speaking to his wife he became very emotional, so much so that he could not continue his conversation with her, much to her disappointment. On another occasion I took with me a professor from Glasgow University. I did not give his name, I knew little about him, but his experience interested me. A voice spoke to him in a language I did not understand. He replied in the same language, and the conversation went on for some time. After the séance was over I asked him what language he was speaking. He replied, "I was speaking Welsh, I am Welsh," and the voice which spoke to me gave the name of an old gardener I employed when I lived in Wales. He knew all about me and what he said was quite true. These two experiences I have never recorded before, nor the fact that my father came back on other occasions and gave me good evidence of his presence and survival, but I could go on and on. Some of my experiences can be found. 85. Related in my books, others I have never publicly told, in fact I have dozens of similar incidents hidden away in my memory or on record, which are as evidential as any I have published. Many departed friends and relations have returned and given their correct names, and good evidence of their survival, but nothing was more amazing than the return of Eric Saunders, as will be reported. Not only was his evidence remarkable, and everything checked later as correct, but he was seen when speaking. The Honourable Everard Fielding, who was such an active member of the Society for Psychical Research, once wrote to me to say that a friend of his would be coming to Glasgow, and would very much like to have a sitting with Sloane. I replied that I would arrange this, and, on the day appointed, Mr. Fielding's friend called to see me at my office. In the evening he dined with me at my club, after which we went to Sloane's house where the sitting was held. This man, during the course of our conversation prior to the séance, never gave me a hint of his occupation, and I purposely asked him no particulars. He was therefore a complete stranger to me, and neither I, nor the medium, nor anybody present at the séance, knew anything about him. The séance was a good one, and during it a voice spoke clearly and distinctly before my new acquaintance. It addressed him correctly, and, when he asked who was speaking, the voice replied, "When on earth I was known as King Edward the Seventh apostrophe." A personal conversation ensued, names of people being mentioned by the voice which my acquaintance knew, and the conversation went on quite naturally just as if my friend was speaking to someone on earth. Finally, the voice said, "I must thank you for all your kindness to my wife, Queen Alexandra. I do not know how she could have gone on without you, and you have relieved her of much worry and care." After the séance was over I asked him if he was satisfied with his strange experience, and he replied, "Most certainly." Then I said, "Will you tell me what your position is towards Queen Alexandra?" "Oh," he replied, "I am the controller of her household." Neither I, nor any other person in the room that night except himself knew this, and it. 86. Therefore follows that the voice that spoke to him was not of this world. Moreover, the person who controlled the voice knew all about him and his friends, which proves that someone, unseen to us, was present with knowledge beyond that of the medium, myself, and the other regular sitters. Queen Alexandra, when she heard about this séance, wanted to sit with Sloane, and this took place in London. I am glad to say that this gave her great satisfaction. Those also present were my friends, Sir William Barrett the eminent physicist, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Dr. Abraham Wallace and Sir Oliver Lodge, all believers in the reality of this phenomena after years of study and experience. Besides them were Sir Thomas Lipton and Marconi, for whose opinions I cannot vouch. Lastly, there was Mr. Bird, the American scientist who did not believe in survival, but he came, he said, with an open mind. A friend of his came back, giving his name, and spoke to him, reminding him of the occasion when they were both together on Brooklyn Bridge and what they then talked about. The voice repeated parts of the conversation they had on the bridge, and to this Bird replied, "That is all true, but how can you speak to me when you are dead?" When we came south to live at Stansted Hall, a friend and near neighbor of ours was the late Frances, Countess of Warwick, a charming woman and overflowing with human kindness. I told her about King Edward coming back to speak to the controller of Queen Alexandra's household, and she replied, "King Edward has often come back to speak to me. We were friends, and when he was on earth we always spoke to each other in German. After his death he has come back to me at seances, and always spoke to me by the direct voice. Just as he always spoke German to me on earth, so he spoke to me in German at these seances." I wish I could give details of one more very evidential conversation which took place. My wife was once with me at a seance with Sloane, when a woman's voice spoke to her and said who she was. I would like to say who she was and what the voice said to my wife about a very personal matter, but I cannot do so as it is much too private. What is important is that only the one claiming to be the person she said she was could have known about it, and what she said to my wife was true and very appropriate. No one present, 87, could possibly have known about the matter to which the speaker referred. I would mention here that Sloane on acquaintance impressed me always as an upright, good, honest man, with little learning, a bad memory and just the average intelligence common to his class. He was a packer at a Glasgow warehouse, and his employer, who was a frequent sitter at his seances, told me he was a trustworthy, upright man. This was the opinion of the very many other people who knew him, and I never once heard uttered a word of suspicion about the honest conduct of his seances. Over 5 years I accumulated so much evidence of survival after death that I wrote and published this book 8 years later. I gave many public lectures and once spoke on my experiences to the members of the Glasgow Philosophical Society at their headquarters, the meeting being packed, and my chairman was the senior law lord of the Court of Session. Then, on the suggestion of a lady, Miss Irwin, I formed the Glasgow Society for Psychical Research, a professor of the university becoming president and I the vice president. This new society had regular private meetings of members and arranged public ones, one being in the St. Andrew's Hall, where 2,000 people heard the eminent physicist Sir William Barrett. I had the honor of being chairman, and remember Barrett in his speech recalling that 40 years earlier in the same hall, at a meeting of the British Association, he had advocated the investigation of telepathy, but that no one gave him any support. Chapter 8. The Evidence, 3A1 Cases. Nothing can destroy the evidence of testimony in any case but a proof or probability that persons are not competent judges of the facts to which they give testimony, or that they are actually under some indirect influence and giving it in such particular case. Till this is made out, the testimony must be admitted. Butler. In this chapter one shall give a summary of 3 cases that I class as A1 and, in the next, of 3 I class as A2. They are only summaries, as I have only space sufficient to enable me to dwell upon the salient points of each. Case I of the A1 group. I took my brother with me to a séance shortly after he was demobilized from the army in 1919. He knew no one present, and was not introduced. No one present, except myself, knew that he had been in the army. No one present knew where he had been during his time in the army. His health had not permitted him to 90 abroad, and he was stationed part of the time near Lowestoft at a small village called Gessingland, and part of the time at Lowestoft, training gunners. With this preliminary explanation, I shall now give you the following summary of my notes on this case. During the course of the sitting, the trumpet was distinctly heard moving about the room, and various voices spoke through it.